Hello, everybody. I don't know what that was, but hello, everyone, and welcome back to yet another episode of Crime at the Family Table podcast. Thank you all for joining us again this week. We are excited to be here once again. We definitely have a great case for you today. This is going to be spearheaded by the I always want to say illustrious as well, but the illustrious, the magnificent, the highly intelligent, ever observant. There was another word, but I forget. But y'all get the drip. Fabulous. Nails always did. Hair always on. Swag always on. My good girl. My co-host Latanya.
Hi.
How are you this week, or beginning of this week?
Yeah, we're starting this week off hot. Well, you know, guys, we didn't get sucked into the portal, you know, as all our conspiracy theories, aunties and uncles thought. So, you know, I'm here recording the pod, you know, after the whole April 8th solar eclipse that we all, you know, went through. And I'm feeling good. Like, I'm feeling okay. Today went by kind of quick for me, though.
It was a pretty, like, there was a flow to today.
Yep. And I literally was working on this pod, like my stuff for the podcast today, y'all. Like, why was that work? Don't tell my boss. I know. All right. So I'm literally this. So this whole topic subject matter, it wasn't the fact that the subject was hard. It was just finding a case that had not been overdone. Like, there's like a few cases, like, I feel like, two of the main cases that came up were the staircase case and the West Memphis 3 case that came up. The staircase case dealing with a husband who is being accused of murdering his wife. It was a huge case. NBC, I believe, that covered it. A few true crime places that covered it. And it's been, like, under a lot of contention and stuff like that. And then the West Memphis 3 is a very well-known case in the true crime community. I mean, literally, the cold case. The show that was based in Philadelphia, Cold Case, did a freaking spinoff episode for, like, this. So, it is very well known. So, I wanted to find a case that was a little bit more, like I didn't know about. And, like, I hadn't seen a lot of true crime podcasters doing. So, if that makes any sense.
I'm excited. Of course, as a disclaimer, we're going to be talking about some heavy things. And if that just doesn't vibe with you today, click off. We have plenty of other episodes that might. But take care of yourself. Take care of your mental health. Like we usually say, grab yourself a cup of tea. Do some yoga. Whatever you need to do to take care of yourself, we're on board.
Yeah. I want to make special note to like a couple of the subjects that will be discussed today. CP will be discussed shortly, but like it is mentioned and murder is mentioned. There are some things like, you know, yeah, like that you like with that type of subject matter, even though it's very brief, like I mentioned it very briefly and I try to sum it up in the best way possible, it is mentioned. And if that's something you're comfortable hearing about, I completely understand. I was very much like when I was doing this case, was feeling a lot of feelings, like a lot of emotion. So I'm giving you guys the warning. So without further ado, here we go. So our case today is dealing with Miss Taylor Bell or Beal. I was not given an understanding of how to necessarily pronounce her last name. So it's between either of those, but I will go with Taylor. And the main terminology we'll be dealing with today is the Alford plea. So Merriam-Webster defines the Alford plea as a guilty plea entered by a criminal defendant who does not admit guilt, but nevertheless pleads guilty as a part of a plea bargain. This can go further into detail, saying that it is used by a defendant who acknowledges that there is enough evidence to potentially convict them, and they take a plea which will minimize any criminal penalties. So, meaning, like, they would take a plea bargain, and they're admitting, quote-unquote, that the prosecution has enough evidence. They are not admitting to them doing anything, but they are saying that they do not have a defense that would be adequate enough to defend them against the prosecution's evidence. So that is where an Alfred plea comes into case. This actually is named after someone. So Henry Alfred was facing the death penalty in 1970 in North Carolina due to his inability to fight his case due to the evidence set against him. He decides to accept a lesser sentence for second-degree murder. He still maintained his innocence, but with no way out, he explained his innocence to the judge, and it was handed. He was handed down a 30-year prison term.
Okay, so I am familiar with this. I'm used to hearing it as just called a plea bargain. Like, they don't often refer to it by its actual formal name.
So, no, there's plea bargains and there's Alfred pleas. So, plea bargains means that you are setting it, that's just a plea bargain. But there is a specific type of plea bargaining, which is called the Alfred plea, which means you do not admit to guilt, which also can put you at risk. So, for when you try to get paroled. Because you are not, part of parole is admitting to guilt, is acknowledging the hurt and the pain that you've given to someone. However, the Alfred plea takes that completely out of the discussion and only lends itself to saying that you are saying that I want to get out in these amount of terms, and this is the terms we can put forth.
So it's a type of, okay, then that makes sense to me. I didn't do it, but there's so much evidence and I don't have any way to defend any more things to defend myself with, so I'm just gonna take, right. I'm gonna take this instead of, is it instead of going to trial and potentially getting more?
Going to trial, and because Mr. Henry Alfred was facing a life term in prison.
Yeah, that makes sense. So
it was one of those things where it was like, I just don't have the adequate services versus like, and you can kind of see it with other people, but a lot of plea bargains, people are admitting to guilt. There is some admission to guilt here. Like, I did something. I'm responsible for something, and they own up to it. Whereas with the Alfred plea, you don't own up to anything.
Okay.
The Alfred is appropriate use. Alfred plea is to say is legit when the defendant is able to intelligently conclude that the plea is the best option available. A judge can, however, conclude otherwise. Only most states do take this, except for Indiana, Michigan, and New Jersey.
I wonder why.
I guess it's because, like, at the end of the day, like, it's also states thing, and it really is. It just depends on precedence of something being, you know, placed. However, I just feel like you can either take a plea bargain, like you can either admit you did something or you're not admitting to it and you're going to trial. Like, we're not playing this game of like in between games. You need to admit to something, give us something to give you this shorter term, or you give us nothing and you get shit.
It just makes me feel like, I wonder how many innocent people have had to use the offer plea, like people who were actually innocent, but they just didn't have enough behind them to prove anything.
Yeah, like the West Memphis 3, that actually is a case that is highly, you know, used for that reason. Like they put that as the top case because in terms of the West Memphis, if people don't know about it, and like I'm probably getting a lot of this wrong, but like from what I remember, the West Memphis 3, three young men who are like late teenagers and things like that, they were accused of killing three children. And these, like, so let's say, like, the young boys, like, were between the ages of, like, 8 and 10. They're between, like, the ages of 13 and 18. Those ages. And because they were alternative, people all, like, accused them, and it was, like, all these people had, you know, the satanic panic was really abundant, and they really faced time for, you know, doing, like, they did go to prison. However, they wanted to get out. Like, they faced life in prison. They wanted to get out. Like, well, at least two of them wanted to get out. And so in order for them to get out, they had to take the Alford plea later on, which would free them, even though there is no substantial evidence of any kind that points to them being the murderers. It actually points greatly against them being the murderers, but because of the justice system's inability to, especially where they're from, to say we got it wrong, they made them take the heat for this. This has happened a few times with the Alford plea. There was another case I know about where it was like these military men were accused of the rape and murder of this woman. It was like five of them. And they basically just threw the book at them and saying, y'all were rapists, y'all murderers, y'all did this. But come to find out, the person who actually did it was a serial rapist and strangler in the area that had actually been doing a crime. So instead of them saying, like, hey, it could potentially been them, they set these men up, made them confess, and in order for them to be released, they had to admit to the Alford plea, even though they ended up finding a serial rapist and he admitted to it. Instead of them saying, oh, well, we got our guy, these guys are free, they sat up here and said, well, no, they met with him in the parking lot and he was a part of doing it with them.
Wow. Okay. It just feels like the offer plea just feels like a setup, but I'll let you
get to it. It's quite a big setup. And then there's one case that we had went over, like the Murdoch case. Actually, one of the Papa Murdoch, he took the offer plea for one of the charges. So sometimes it isn't like even, he just didn't like, but like I said, like for some people, it isn't like they're, like the book is being thrown out unfairly. Sometimes it's just the stacking up of things. Like, he ain't got no alibi for where he was. It was one of the charges with the murders of his son and his wife. So he just took the Alford plea because he was just like, you know, I ain't really got no defense for that. I was at the house. Y'all saw me. There's evidence that says I was there. So, yeah. So that, like, you know, those are some of the examples and where the Alford plea has been used. And, you know, it kind of can be a good thing because it kind of stops wasting the court's time. But then another bad thing, it can really set up innocent people to being forced into taking that type of plea. And when you take that kind of plea as like the West Memphis Three and the men that were accused of the rape of the woman in the apartment, so they cannot basically get any financial compensation for their time in prison because they're technically agreeing to guilt for the crime. So they're making the state not liable for their time in prison. Listen, that's what we're going to start saying. Like, every time the justice system do crazy shit, we're just going to say it's a team, a scheme cooked up by Todd. Because there's no way that it's, no. Somebody, the other thing is Queen Naja. They love saying Queen Naja did it.
Why?
Yeah, for some reason, they be like, Queen Naja. Like, for some reason, I don't know why this happens, but she's another name that keeps being brought up. And she really ain't do nothing. And it came from literally nowhere. It's not like Candy's mama came up here and was like a scheme cooked up by Queen Naja. No, no one said it. Just somebody made it up.
That is... Poor Queen Naja. But also...
They really be just catching them. Just catching them straight is crazy. All right. So let's get into our case for today. Again, another quick warning. This case does deal with murder and the discussion of CP is involved in this discussion. So again, this is another time where you can break away real fast. Okay. So Taylor Bill, by all accounts, had the world at her fingertips and was ready to take it on without any issues. She was a 17-year-old on her first year of college. She is from Vienna, Virginia, and she was only a few weeks into her freshman year at Virginia Commonwealth University. And it seemed, by all accounts, like everything was going fine and there were nothing to be worried about. Nothing substantial happened. Like, first couple weeks, you really just getting acclimated. You're getting introduced to your roommate. You are getting kind of used to campus. And you're kind of getting, you're trying to figure out maybe what classes you want to drop before you no longer can do drop ed. I know that that's what I was doing my first few weeks of college, especially freshman year. Taylor lived was now living a few hours away from home in Richmond, Virginia at her school. And being the only child to her mother, Janet, that just seemed like way too much. Like, they were thick as thieves. Being the only child to her mother, you know, this time felt like just breaking apart. It made her mother, Janet, anxious and worried because she felt like she was just too far, even though she was just 2 short hours. During the Labor Day weekend, which was 2 weeks into school, the weekend of September 5th, Taylor had spent time with her mom and other friends for the weekend. And as quickly as the weekend came, as quickly as the weekend ended, and Taylor was heading back to school. Taylor made her way back to the dorms, and she shared with her roommate, Emma Ellsworth. She settled in by calling her friends and parents to let them know, hey, I've arrived, I'm safe. She talked to them talked to some friends for a few hours, talked to her parents. And according to her roommate, Taylor then told her she would be out for a few hours and she would be back. Nothing seemed amiss. And with classes commencing back on Monday, nothing gave Emma the impression that Taylor would be gone for too long. I mean, they had classes the next day, like they had to go. And this wasn't in the age of, you know, this was 2005 we're talking about here. So, you know, it was no online Zoom classes. We were dealing with, you had to be in that classroom sitting there. Listen, you had to be there and with your notebook ready. Wasn't no, oh, can you record the class for me? None of that. You had to be in class. However, when Monday came, and with Taylor's books untouched and bed looking unslept in, concern grew. Emma contacted the VCU, as it was called, campus police, who then contacted Janet to let her know that both Taylor and her car were not there at her dorm. The VCU then questioned friends and acquaintances because they thinking to themselves, maybe Taylor wandered off. You know, she's a freshman, maybe some jitters, maybe she's staying over at a friend's house, maybe she went out drinking and she just didn't come back home yet. But nothing came of it. So after 10 days, during this time, Janet is trying to get the word out with media about her daughter being missing. The VCU police finally, through their investigation, finally went to the Richmond police. That bothered me so much when I read that. I was like, that is just horrible. But that still happens to this day. College police think that they are regular police. Yeah. Like, you're a campus police person. You don't have the bandwidth, and a lot of that stuff is based in kind of not to draw too much attention to the case, because if it, like, it makes the school look bad. To not make the school look bad, that's just minimizing. But 10 days, y'all are losing valuable time here, folks.
You lose it in the first 48. We know that. Like,
the first 48. Also, this case was on 48 hours. So that was crazy. And it's just like, y'all are missing the clues. Like, a lot of what could have been found, it really could have been lost in those 10 days. But luckily, you know, things are found out. But it's just like, we could have definitely probably made this case go way quicker had the police been instantaneously involved.
Yeah. Even because filing a missing persons report doesn't take 2 weeks for a person doesn't have to be missing for 2 weeks an adult or what's considered an adult. So they could have gotten this again in like 48 hours.
And you can't say that, oh, maybe Taylor just didn't want to go to school because she was home already over the long weekend. So she could have just stayed where she was. Why the hell would she just come back to school?
And then disappear. She could have not, even if she didn't want to go to school, she didn't have to go to class.
Right. Like, it just didn't make sense. But here we are, 10 days later. So Chief Rodney Monroe put a task force together, a mixture of university, state, and federal investigators to deal with the sheer volume of info that would come up. Early on, the last person to have seen Taylor was a man named Ben Fawley. Ben met Taylor with her dad in February of 2005 when they visited the campus. Taylor stayed the night at this time with her friend who was Fawley's roommate. And now, you know, that's how he knows her. That's kind of how he's coming up. But he was like the last person, and they had stayed in contact. So he said that he saw Taylor and she was really upset about her breakup that she had with her boyfriend. After a meeting with him, the police talked to Taylor's boyfriend, Jacob Cunningham, who told them that, yes, he saw Taylor and they had dinner the night of September 5th, which was Labor Day weekend, which was the Sunday, but that there was no issues as they had made up. So, and, you know, Detective Jason Hudson basically said, oh, well, he seems like a good young man and nothing seems wrong with this situation. And he was just like, but with his timeline also on top of that, it just didn't seem like, it seemed like everything was cut and dry. Like, he seen Taylor and, you know, they made up and everything was fine. He also said that Jacob mentioned that Taylor was planning on going skateboarding that night. And this kind of corroborates with the fact that Taylor was seen on campus security cameras around 10:24 p.m. So she was seen at a point in time, and that would have been way after dinner. They weren't planning on meeting. It was just dinner. Dinner, and she was going to go skateboarding later.
They had dinner. They made up. You don't call, or you don't, like, I don't know. If I just got my girlfriend back or my boyfriend or whatever, like, I'm going to probably be like, thank you for dinner. You know, there's going to be more exchange than just like, oh, no, she just left and she was going to go skateboarding. Like,
right. Which kind of makes sense, because I'm just like, I was thinking to myself for a second, I was just like, wait, but where the fuck was the skateboard? But then I realized, oh, no, she has a car. So she took her car and skateboard was right in her car. And she probably went somewhere else, but there is no acknowledgement of any place else she went beyond going to dinner and 10 p.m. So there's no really in the middle stuff we're here seeing about. It takes another 10 days and Taylor's car is found in a residential street not far from campus. Bloodhounds then bring them to a specific home. However, through that search, they were never able to find a reasonable suspect. There was no reasonable suspect found from where her car was. So then, you know, police were just like, okay, this is stupid. Let's circle back. So they come back to Ben Fawley, and he is known on campus for his colorful hair and even more colorful van, which was covered in stickers. He seemed to have holes in his timeline, however. With that being said, to bring us back to his first meeting with Taylor, Matt, Taylor's father, did not feel weird about him when they first met, because he was just like, hey, like, you know, this friend, your roommate's with them, like, it's nothing. And also, Taylor didn't seem weirded out by him and anything like that. However, any suspicion or weirdness that he may have not felt, he probably would have if he really knew everything he needed to know about Ben. Ben was not a student at VCU. He was actually a dropout. And he wasn't what Matt thought was a mid-20-year-old. Ben was 37 years old.
What?
Yes. A 37-year-old that is roommates with someone who 17-year-old Taylor is sleeping over the house of.
How long ago did you drop out and you're still hanging around?
And can't on campus.
Trying to hang on to your glory days.
And mind you, he's known on campus. Like, people see him on campus. Like, he is around on campus. Like, so it's just like, and he's known for his gothic way of dressing, kind of like alternative and stuff like this. Like, he is a really polarizing figure. Like, if you We all know those people that were polarizing. My polarizing figure on my campus was the guy who wore shorts, like shorts that went to his kneecaps all year round with flip-flops. It didn't matter if it was snow, sleet, shine, rain. He was wearing those. That was our polarizing figure.
Hey, who was ours? We had a guy we used to call Little Shorts because his shorts were really little. And I think he wore those shorts year-round, too.
Find out the guy who was wearing the shorts year-round and with the sandals, he was from Alaska. So the reason why he wore them around is because he was from Alaska and he was just like, it's not really cold to me. But they were always the same shorts. So this was always a strange thing. Some people want to be different. And he also had a ponytail. He was blonde and he had ponytails and he had those wireframe glasses. Like, I just remember, because he was so interesting. And I, like, working in the criminology department, like, I was in the middle of, like, the Grove. So, like, all the other classes, the big buildings you had to walk past. So he would always come past that building because I guess he lived, like, next door to campus. So he would always just have to walk out. And I would just always see him and I'd be like,
what's your story?
What is your story? And somebody had apparently asked him, and yeah, apparently he's from Alaska. Also, the president of our university also was from Alaska, too. So that's why we would never get out of school when it was snow, because he said, yeah, this is like our...
This ain't it.
Right.
Like, they hate that. Oh, that's so funny that it's a person wearing shorts on both campuses. You can tell we went to predominantly white institutions.
Yes, PWIs. We went to PWIs, baby. And, like, that's a PWI feature. Like, we never had golf kids, but we also had, like, these group of people who would do, like, medieval, like, fighting with the sword things, like, fake swords in, like, the middle of campus. And it's called something, and, like, and they would just play make-believe. It was kind of like Dungeons and Dragons and shit like that. And, like, they were really cool. And they would just always meet up and they would just, like, fight. Like, fake fight with, like, the swords.
Oh, I do know what it's called. It's not cosplay. It's, I know what it's called. I can't think of it.
Yeah, and, like, they would do that. And I was just like, you know what? People probably making fun of them, but they probably having the best fucking time of their life.
They're probably having a lot of sex, too.
And getting the draws, okay? I promise you, them people is freaky deaky in them groups. I promise you, the cosplayers, the people that the alternative folks, be getting it. Like, it'd be a lot of stuff going on in them groups. It really do. Mm-hmm. And they all be like, and they go to the meetings and, like, the stuff, like, you know, the events and the cons and all that stuff. So they be having fun. They be having a good time. We boring.
Sitting up here so much about what people think.
Poor loco.
Yeah. Oh, I just, my stomach churned. What did you say?
Poor loco.
Oh, I can taste it.
Oh my God. Vlad, Four Loco. Like, that was just a time. A time.
Let's not talk about it.
Oh God, I can smell it. Ooh.
I know. Ooh. I just,
it smelled like regret. All right. So now we get into Ben. So after, you know, Taylor meets with Ben at the school in February, when she leaves and comes back home, she continues emailing him. Because, yes, y'all, there was no sliding into the DMs. If you wanted to talk to somebody continuously, you talk to them on email. Okay?
Or chat, yeah.
Yeah, chat, like, it's wild times. Taylor's best friend spoke about, like, this encounter with Ben and saying that, you know, after they had met, Taylor then had went back to VCU campus and stayed there by herself. She went there alone and she stayed there. It probably was around springtime and she stayed there. She did say that her and Ben, you know, they did have an intimate time, but it really was a one night thing and it wasn't something she'd take serious. And even when, you know, mentioning him, she would never mention about dating or anything like that. It was just a one night thing. And she kind of just liked the attention because Ben was, like, really about giving her compliments. Like, he showed her a lot of interest. And being a 17-year-old, I can imagine what that can do. Like,
yeah,
if you are, especially even if he wasn't a 37-year-old and she's a freaking minor, like, I can see it in this, like, just thinking of, like, just a college guy, giving me attention, that would have intrigued and piqued my interest, because I would have been like, oh, so you're feeling me. What about these other college girls? You have access to all these other college girls. What about me?
You're so mature. You're so older. Yeah.
And when Ben is talked to by police about his encounter, like, he mentions about how beautiful Taylor was and how, you know, he was just drunk. Like, it was just really... Ben is just weird. Ben is weird, and it's going to get worse for Ben, so I just want to set the stage.
So, Ben and Taylor had a one-night thing, Ben and the other girl. No. He not getting arrested for that? Like,
right. So, we're not getting there yet. Not getting there yet. So... And one of Folly's exes talks about how intriguing Ben could be, saying that he could come off very doting and very making your just like your self-esteem go up with all the attention he would give you.
It's giving very much love bombing.
Yes, it's giving very much like it's giving very much strange because like even the ex-girlfriend is 24. She's a 24-year-old and he's still 30. Like, I mean, it's just, it's not like you're in your 30s. Like, you should be having kids. Like, why are you still talking to a 17-year-old? Why are you trying to talk to a 17-year-old? However, he can be very jealous, which was one of the reasons that it caused her to break up with him. And when she did end things with Ben, Ben called himself breaking into her apartment, the ex-girlfriend, and with a can of mace and a hammer. He didn't do anything to her, but it was just something to make her fearful. The task force then, through further investigation, found out this was not the only incident of Ben's. Young girls who had contact with him had said he had been threatening, assaulted, or they had felt threatened by him. One such incident is in 2003. He was convicted of assaulting an ex-girlfriend. This is already only 2 years prior to this case. Like he's assaulted somebody that we know of. Going back to Folly in the Taylor situation, Ben admitted to having sex with Taylor to police, which made her a minor, which gave cause for a search of his apartment. Now, this is where the warning comes in. Through the search, detectives were shook. In Folly's apartment was a massive amount of graphic CP of children between the ages of 3 and 4 being assaulted.
Nope.
Then, of course, denies ownership of these materials, claiming that they were the previous tenants, but police were not falling for it, and it didn't matter because any possession of CP, and this is for anybody out there, any possession of CP, whether it is you are the original owner of that CP, if it was within your possession, you are facing a felony charge, which led to his arrest. Good. Through the search of his computer, officers found random photos from everything. So he was like an amateur photographer, like taking things.
Of course he was.
Taking things like around the, you know, the state of Virginia, like different parts, like buildings, stuff like that. The police then speak with an ex of Ben's, who is also a friend to Taylor. Her name is Erin Crabble. And police show Aaron thousands of photographs from his computer. And through those photographs, Aaron points out that one of the photos being an abandoned home, which is next to Aaron's parents' property. Aaron didn't think much of this when she told police. She felt like, I might be wasting her time. It could be nothing. Little does Aaron know is that she cracked this case wide open with her telling police about this abandoned home. When police get to the farm area, they immediately are met with a smell that they will never forget. This smell leads them to a shallow grave with remains. These remains, of course, are Taylor Bell's. Janet finds out that her daughter, that these are her daughter's remains. There are, due to this being a month into, you know, her disappearance, Taylor being exposed to the elements, this is the beginning of September in Virginia, bugs and animals, she is pretty much skeletal remains. It is hard to figure out why, what happened exactly, but they are, because of the shallow grave part, they know that this is a murder. They know this is a homicide. So when Fawley is informed about these findings to police, he goes on a rant. He says, I don't have no involvement. He didn't do it, blah, blah, blah. However, he then proceeds to admit that him and Taylor had consensual sex when he picked her up from the dorms. This is corroborated by him being seen on the same campus camera that caught Taylor. He was caught 3 minutes prior at 10:21 on campus, or by the campus cameras. Now, here's all the holes. These are the holes that we're finding. Because this is what was happening. Prior to this, he does not admit to seeing, being with Taylor longer than, like, figuring out about the boyfriend breaking up situation. But now we're getting a little bit more into the information, to the truth pile. All right? Ben stated that he and Taylor were drinking over his apartment. So after, you know, they call Cameron, they drive off and go to the apartment. Taylor and him were drinking, and Taylor was egging him on. He says that Taylor wanted to do something, you know, more, and wanted to get, like, real sexual. And that him and Taylor basically hopped into his car and they drove to Matthew County, where her remains were found, mind you. Matthew County, well, close to Matthew County, they were in the car and they got into what he says Taylor called it, which was monkey play or whatever. But it is better known as erotic asphyxiation. He stated that Taylor wanted to pass out during sex for a thrill, but he was new to it. He just didn't have, you know, he's a virgin and he, you know, okay. he didn't know. And this 17-year-old, she just opened his eyes and he was just, you know, down to for whatever. He claims that they went to the backseat of Taylor's car and then they began to do the erotic asphyxiation, and the erotic asphyxiation included putting a bag over Taylor's head. And he said that Taylor seemed fine, but then all of a sudden, she was passed out and was unresponsive. And instead of calling 911, he was freaking out because he was worried. Not worried enough to call 911, I might mind you. But worried about his own self. So he drives Taylor's car with her still in the back to campus, leaves her in the car, goes home and proceeds to go to sleep, then goes back and finds out that Taylor is still, you know, unresponsive. So he's still freaking out and worried. So this leads him to taking her car back to Matthew County, where she was found in the shallow grave, and he put her in there. Yeah.
Again, at any time, you could have called the police and been like, hey, we were playing. They have hospitals and ambulances have heard of these things before. It wouldn't be the only accident or incident like that if it was actually true. At any point,
Even during accidental death, you could still be charged with manslaughter, but that is very different than the cold, calculated way of leaving her body to animals and bugs, and her mother and father not being able to bury her and giving her a burial that is respective to her body. Like, yep. he didn't even put her, like, she wasn't covered with dirt. She was just in the grave.
What was the point of the shallow grave? Like,
none, because he's an idiota. Like, he's really dumb. So, again, the exact cause of death is not able to be found. But Ben still is charged with first-degree murder because they do believe that he intentionally, you know, killed her. This is further corroborated by the fact that the prosecution prosecutors Jack Gill and Chris Bullard called bullshit on all the claims that Ben was making up, because they stated that he even himself in his admission admitted to duct taping Taylor and also being angry with her and telling her to shut up. Because somebody, you're always going to trip yourself up when you tell a lie. You're always going to tell yourself. No matter what you do, the truth shall seep out because your conscience cannot allow it. You cannot remember the lie. So, however, Ben is still claiming that, oh no, the duct tape was not to, you know, restrain her. It was to, because she wanted it to make a fake kidnapping scene. Now,
is it monkey play or kidnap? People all of the above. Like,
and my whole thing is, she don't even know you like that. Like, BDSM is generally something that's done between trusted partners and people you have a contract with. Like, you do not. Erotic asphyxiation is something that is very dangerous, and it's always the main thing that people like to use when they try to, like, when they just try to kill their partner, and they're like, oh yeah, like, we just got into some choking.
We just got
a little too rough. You can't prosecute me. We're just getting rough. We're just getting rough. You wouldn't understand BDSM. And it's just like, no, bro, we understand, but you're still culpable in the murder, even if it's BDSM, and you still should have called 911 when it got beyond yourself. Like, at the end of the day, that is why you don't play around with stuff, especially when you're under the influences of drugs and alcohol. Like, even if it was true, you just don't do certain things. You're not smart. Like, you're not smart because the lies are just, like, tripping you up. And what 17-year-old knows anything about bondage? Like, knows anything about erotic asphyxiation?
Thank you. Maybe a handcuff at that age. Maybe
just handcuff. Like, ooh.
But like, no, like,
maybe a little smack, no. A little tap on the booty. Like, maybe something, but, like, not that. The 37-year-old, though, with droves of CP that deals with the R word of children would know about that type of stuff, because he's into that type of that dangerous type of lifestyle. And he literally, like, just the sense of dragging this woman through the mud and just trying to make her seem like this big old slut, and she was just down for whatever, and she let this man who was 20 years her senior. She told him what she wanted.
I'm not buying it.
Nobody buys it. The only people that seem to be buying is his defense team, of course, because his defense team. His defense team stated that. I want to make sure we understand who the defense team is. Their names were Chris Connells and Bill Johnson, and they felt like the case was a big way to play on the conservative values of the Matthew County at the time. So they were just going to make it out like, so it wasn't even the fact that they're saying, she died during sex play, but, you know, because Matthew County is very conservative, and the type of lines they like to draw people in is very sweet girls and very gentlemen. And if they could play up that Taylor was not a very sweet girl, an innocent girl, they may be able to get him off for murder.
Yep.
And even though the evidence would show to the contrary, even her best friend stated that, by all accounts, Taylor was basically approved. Like, even though she did have an intimate time, it doesn't say that they had sex. It just says intimate time. And that could be anything.
Yeah.
Any number of things. Taylor was just not that type of person. And, like, she wasn't even interested in bondage or erotic asphyxiation. There was no internet history of that type of information. She has never had any conversations with any of her friends about those type of conversations. But apparently the defense says, like, oh no, we have evidence to show the contrary. And they said that they believe that they can convince a 12-person jury of this information if given the opportunity. They were never given that opportunity.
What does it say? Come on.
Because Ben, with his big old yapper, decided during a jailhouse call with the officer, He described his statement to police about the erotic asphyxiation as a strategy in order to beat the system.
These calls are recorded.
Recorded calls. They tell you that? They tell you that. They tell you that on the phone. Right, right, right. To add insult to injury onto his case, Ben wrote a letter to another ex-girlfriend. This 37-year-old man has plenty of ex-girlfriends. He basically admitted to responsibility for the murder, like admitting to guilt. And then, like, in the letter, he kind of just, like, he gets really, like, melodramatic and shit. Like, talking about, like, I'm just a dark soul, all thinking about all this killing and stuff. I guess, you know, it just made, like, I finally, you know, did my thing. And it's just like, boy, bye. And with that, this is how we get into the Alford plea. Because the defense really had no other options, because he basically been really shot their fucking defense into the foot, for real. The Alford plea was struck, where Folley agreed to second degree murder. And I feel like I want to throw up when I found this out. All the CP charges were dropped.
How?
He faced up to 5 years per CP. If he did not plead. This, and because he was facing up basically a life sentence with everything in combination, he only was sentenced to 30 years. Before being sentenced, Ben remained quiet in front of the judge, but Janet, Taylor's mother, did not. She yelled, "Murderer," as she was led out of the courtroom, and she did not let that break her. Like, she was just like, no, my daughter, no, you are not getting away with this. You are a murderer. You do not get to, you know, not admit to what you did. You do not get to sit there and be quiet this whole time while I deal in anguish. And, you know, it was just completely heartbreaking. Folley, because this case happened in 2005 with the trial kind of ending in 2006, Folley is expected to be released in 2031 at the age of 64.
2031. That's not long from now.
Not at all. And the fact that he'll be 64 is crazy. He was old as shit. Like,
he was old dealing with these young girls.
My mom's age.
I feel like he's gonna just get out and find him a young girl to leech off of, and
because he's not considered a sex, he's not a registered sex offender.
Which is wild. You had CP. You definitely, it was a statutory situation with this young girl. Why not on the
offender? Because if you really think about it, but the thing is, it's just like, I just feel like the things that he did, so this is the theory that basically the prosecution had, which was that they believed that Ben picked Taylor up to have, like, you know, a little talky talk. And Taylor rejected him, and he got mad. This is further proven through his admissions of that he got angry during that discussion, and he told her to shut up. And, you know, it really just seemed like it was slipping out. And really, had they had more time with him, I feel like he really, really, really admitted to it. But he claims he was never rejected. It was nothing for me to be angry about. I was never rejected. We weren't anything serious anyway. And I know, I just feel like, maybe she didn't reject you in terms of a relationship, but she rejected you definitely in terms of sexual advancement. And you are known to be violent. You assault people. You have CP. You are a dangerous person, and you will reoffend. He has the ability to reoffend. And if they do not put him on some type of monitoring program when he is released, he will hurt someone else. He has no reason not to.
Really think he needs to be on the offenders list, if nothing less for the CP. Like,
right. Like, because the CP is, like, to me, the smoking gun. And the fact of the matter is, he had the 17-year-old because she was going to school. And like she was going to his, like, so like he was able to gain access. Like, I feel like he's always wanted, and he would go younger if he was able to. He would have gone. Like, I mean, it was just a crime of opportunity, and it's so sad because, you know, Taylor has so much of her life to live, and so much of, you know, was taken from her, and so much of her life and love was taken from her parents. And, you know, Taylor was not known for as somebody with a big group of friends, but she was an impact. Like, she made a huge impact. She always stood up for the little guy. She was always, you know, just so loving and compassionate and caring of others. And her mom, her dad, and her friends are going to really miss her. A few of the things that also came up at the end of the article, which I felt like really, you know, gave us a little bright light to, like, such a dark situation, is Aaron Crabble received $20,000 as a reward for her help in the case. And with that, she used part of it to establish a fund for women in crisis in honor of Taylor. Taylor's mother, Janet, went on to write a book titled Love You More, which was a special phrase her and Taylor would use to end their conversations. So we really, you know, we are left with the what of what Taylor's life could have been, because a freaking sicko by the name of Ben Fawley decided that he wanted to pretend like he deserved, like he wants to pretend like he was somebody he wasn't, which was a younger person. I don't know if Taylor exactly knew if he was 37. Like, she might have through being friends with Aaron. But my whole thing is, he pretended like he was somebody he wasn't. He pretended like he was this nice guy. He was chill or whatever. And then to go on and just be this sick fucking freak who is just a danger to everyone, a danger to women and children and society. Because he will, if given the opportunity, that man will reoffend. And I hope when he is released, that he is released under tight supervision. Because if not, he is a danger of reoffending. And I do know that definitely when you're getting into the South, people tend to, when they are sex offenders and people like that, they tend to move to small towns if they even are on the registry. But because he is not on the registry, he can live wherever the F he wants without any provisions.
No. He's not going to live out the rest of his days across the street from a playground. Because, you know, people like that will, PDFs will set themselves up in places like that, and then he'll come across as the innocent old man. Let's just, I mean, 65 is not old anymore by any means, but he'll come across as the innocent old man on the block, and no one will know.
Right. And the sad part is, and then on top of that, let's just not talk about the fact that now exists TikTok. At the end of the day, is this huge conversation going around of parent vlog, like parent that have pages dedicated to their children, and the safety of their children, and basically the threat that they put their children under by having them on the internet, and basically under TikTok having all these shares and saves of tens of thousands of fucking people are saving your children's information or changing your child's image. It ain't a sane person. It is a predator. And these people do not have to go into the dark web. They can get their fixes by going on to TikTok and the internet and finding images of children. And that is the danger that this man is. Because as much as they try to claim, like, oh, like, it was just his former tenant, I don't believe that. That is a complete and utter lie, because where they found that information, they did not have to look hard for those images. It was a massive amount, and any sane person would have gotten rid of those pictures if they were the quote-unquote former tenants. He is a liar, and he is a dangerous society, and, you know, I really do hope that there are provisions that are able to be put in place to protect people and to maybe make sure that he cannot do this to nobody else, because I do believe that he can hurt someone else. He was just waiting. He was just buying his time.
I feel like it's only a matter of time. Hopefully not. But, like, he's one of those guys that's like, it's only a matter of time before he strikes again, if given the opportunity. And I feel like, I hope he lay low and just live out the rest of his life quietly, because...
Quiet.
Just like, because as soon as you said the CP was the previous tenant, first of all, how long were you living in that space? If you were living in that apartment or whatever for more than a couple of days or more than a month, like, you saw that. Why would you not get rid of it? Like, anybody in their right mind, if they saw that that was there and they're like, oh my God, gross, this is the previous tenant, you're gathering it up, you put it in a trash bin, you might even be burning it so nobody will think that it's you.
Right. That is what, like, he is playing on the fact that, again, that was the, like he's a strategist. Like, he's somebody who, he just gonna lie and he gonna see how far he can go because he think everybody else around him is dumb.
But it is you, sir, that is really dumb.
Very, very much dumb. And I just know that he is, you know, and you know what? Life in for him in prison probably went a lot easier for him because he did not have those CP charges.
Yep. Because, you know, they would have tore him up if they would have found out he hurt children or anything.
Like, they're crazy. It's just, like, crazy. And they said a massive amount. Which means, and men like that, it's just like with any addiction, they are going to find themselves finding that type of stuff again. Like, they just cannot stop because he's a sicko and that's just the type of mindset he is. So again, I caution people to be very, you know, aware that in 7 years, which is really not long from now, he will be released and he'll be 64 years old and he will not be that old. And you know what's even crazier to me? I will be the age he was when he was committing this murder by the time he gets out.
That is wild.
And as a 30-year-old person, I couldn't even imagine dealing with somebody who was a freshman in fucking college, let alone a 17-year-old. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine dealing, like, I'd be like 25, you a baby. I don't know what makes me think that, but literally I do, because I just be like, your brain just got developed. You need a couple more years under your belt. I don't know.
If you can't rent a car, because you know you got to be, what, 24 to rent a car or a hotel? One of those. You have to be like 25, 24 to rent it. If you can't rent a car, we can't go out. It's just like, what do we have in common that far of an age gap? That's 20 years of an age gap.
And I just love how Taylor was literally paying his ass dust. Like, she really just was just not, she was like, I'm not dating this man.
She
was what it was.
And that's what pissed him off.
Yes, because she probably was just like, boy, I have a boyfriend.
And I'm 17, bro. Like, we did what we did, but like...
That was like a springtime, whatever it was. And I gotta get back to my real life because me and my man... I mean, we did have a little argument because for some reason, somehow, some way, he knew about this argument. So, which means they were probably in communication still while she was in school.
Yeah.
But it really just makes no sense to me because, bruh, she really was not trying to do it with you. She literally... doesn't care about you, and you got mad, and you live your life in delusional land. Yeah. Well, you thought that this 17-year-old, I just don't understand why in any reality that would not have been weird. Like, you cannot take no 17-year-old, no 18-year-old nowhere for real.
They can't drink, they can't smoke cigarettes. Like, I'm thinking of all the things. You can't do anything at 17. You're not a legal adult, and that's just weird.
And this is why I do have a struggle with young people, even though they graduate early, being on college campuses.
I can understand that.
Because here we are with a, like, you got them super seniors, like, because I know we all know about these people, like, the super seniors who preyed upon freshmen.
They wasn't 37, though. That, now...
You also in the late 23. Like, some of them would be in their late 20s. Like, it was guys who I thought... were like really young, and come to find out they were supposed to graduate when I was a freshman, and I have graduated and they still never graduated.
I do know a super senior myself, but he wasn't that far from, I want to say he probably graduated like a year, maybe two after we were supposed to. And at that point you're like, what, 23? 24. I think he would have been about like 23, 24, but still. Right.
But it's like the guys that just prey upon freshmen. It was just like, dads would be throwing me with them super seniors. Like, yeah, you can be old, but like, be old, be yourself. Like, go to class.
Be wise. Like,
you need to be hanging around with the master students. Like, that's like, I don't know.
Yes, the teacher's aide.
Like, right, like, you don't need to be around nobody. Like, and the fact is, he been dropped out. This guy been dropped out. And he's still on his campus, and no one felt as though it was weird, like that it was weird that this guy was still known on campus and hanging around. Like, this is where I'm throwing, like, a lot of things kind of went amiss. And the fact is that he assaulted somebody 2 years prior. He really should not have been allowed anywhere near that freaking campus.
No, because there are still minors on the campus. Like, some people there are 16, some people there are like, I went to school when I was a freshman, I was 17. So it's like, there does need to be some restrictions, and I hope it is now, or better ones now. There do need to be some restrictions on campus things, because I know you can't catch everybody. Some people will come from different places, and they might be a little bit older, but like 37, and he was like a dropout. So you're not even a super senior. You don't even go here anymore.
Right, like. Mind you, bro, it's probably been so long since you went to the school. Like, you got to start over.
Yes. It's like, you're almost 40. That's just gross.
You're 15 years away from when you should have graduated.
Why are you still here, bro?
Like, even if you went to school late, because, of course, like, I had people, like, you know, my school police officers, they went to school with me. Like, there were some school police officers that went to school, and that was because if they got an associate's or a BA, they could have went into, like, more, like, higher fields and within the police force. But they were not freaking hanging around college kids. Like, they were hanging around the professors. They were cooling with the professors. They were not hanging around the freaking students. Like, they just weren't doing that. I find this case completely just annoyingly easy to, in my sense, easy to solve, because like, this shouldn't been a case, because this man's really on campus. And on top of that, the fact is that the campus police also failed this girl, where they waited freaking 10 days, because I'm pretty sure they could have found this situation out way sooner had the police been well informed. Her body would not have laid in a freaking shallow grave for 10 days.
They were trying to protect the school.
Yeah.
In the image of the school, which F them.
VCU is Virginia Commonwealth University. I want to make that very known. Virginia Commonwealth University, that is a school. And that's just trifling. I really need schools to do better, because they still do that stuff to this day, especially when it comes to sexual assault. And crimes that happen on campus, they like to keep things on the DL. And it's just like, no, we need real police officers with real money and funds to investigate these cases.
Yeah, for sure. But let
me put my little soapbox and just say, to end this case off, you know, rest in peace to Taylor. And, you know, I'm sending her family, friends, and loved ones a lot of love. And, you know, because grief, of course, is not a, you know, you get over a type thing. It's something you carry with you, and it is ever present and always there. And you just, it's something you live with. It's not something you live past. And I completely feel for you. And I do, you know, hope for peace. And I hope that there is never a day of peace for Ben Fowley. I hope that he stubs his toe every time he gets up. I hope his balls fall. Like, I hope every time he gets up out of his bunk, he hits his head. I just hope whenever he tries to turn a page of a book, he gets a paper cut. That is what I wish for that man. And that is all.
Well, to end this episode, our third co-host is going to take us out. Say thanks for listening.